the show.
Hey everyone, and Merry Christmas. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson, for this episode of The Boundless Show, a special episode this week and next. As promised, it is the best of Boundless in 2010, and we just wanted to look back on some of the clips that were fun, that we thought were fun, that we thought were memorable, that we thought impacted us in a special way. And you all called in, and we were able to feature some of your calls on these next two shows. And so we're very excited to do so. As we kick off, I just wanted to just reflect on the year and realize that there were a lot of changes this year. Thank you all for sticking with us on the show, and we hope that you continue to do so. It's been really great. I'm excited about 2011, and so hopefully you will come along for the ride there. So as I was looking back on this year's shows, I actually went through all of the podcast posts because I, as many of you will find hard to believe, I'm sure, I don't actually listen to these every day. I don't sit every day of the week and review podcasts that I've done in the past. So I was like, huh, what did we do? But in doing so, just had some great memories of interviewing guests, of being on roundtables, of talking to different folks, and really of having my opinions changed on several different things and some things that I really did learn. So I will probably share my favorite clip next week on this show, my favorite clip of this year. And it was hard to choose. I mean, it was like there were just a bunch that I liked. Some of the ones that I liked included Keith and Chantel Hobbs. You remember them from earlier on in the year. She is an author, and they talked a lot about dealing with image, especially with women and kind of their marriage and how they've weathered her weight loss specifically and how that has changed her in particular, but also them. Very cool. A neat, neat couple. I also love talking to Ron Luce, and remember that I both tweeted and Facebooked his comment that said, for God so loved the world that he did not send a text, he sent himself in person. And I thought that was huge and just gave us really a call to get involved in the lives of teens, and that made a huge impact on me. I also loved hearing from Gianna Jessen. You remember that interview from earlier on in the year. I also loved talking to Henry Cloud. You know that he dished some stuff out for me, and that was very questionable, and I had to give it back to him on some of his ideas, so that was a really fun interview, and we've kind of kept up a little banter since then as well. You'll hear some stuff from me, some of the stuff that I loved. But right now I want to start out with our own Dave Sockeld, his favorite clip. You know, he works the board for us. He is our engineer. He puts these shows together, edits them, records them. Actually, he records them and then edits them. And then he's just fun. He offers his little witticisms throughout as well. In addition to maybe sometimes telling me that I go on and on a little bit too much. So I'm sure I'll be hearing after this show. Anyway, we'll start out with Dave's clip, and then we will go ahead and play a few of yours. So listen in.
Thanks, Lisa. My favorite interview that we got to do this year was with a gentleman from Grand Cayman. He's a pastor down there, Thabiti Anabwile. And Thabiti was really interesting because he was a guy who became a Muslim during college, and he eventually got out of that and is now a pastor at a Baptist church down there in Grand Cayman. And he talks in this segment about witnessing to Muslims, and not just Muslims, but to everyone around us.
I get asked the question, well, how do you witness to a Muslim?
Mm-hmm.
You witness to a Muslim like you witness to everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
I think it betrays a lack of confidence in the gospel as the power of God whenever we say, you know, anyone, a Muslim or any other person, is sort of beyond the reach of God's saving arm. His arm is not certain that he cannot save.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to exhort people to place radical confidence in this message which God tells us in his word is, in fact, the power of God to everyone who believes, to the Jew first, and also to the Gentile, which includes the Muslim neighbor or friend or coworker. That same message which saved us, which overcame our hardened hearts is the same message which will conquer the hearts of people from Muslim backgrounds. We live with a lot of stereotypes. We live in a lot of fear, and those things tend to paralyze us. But at the bottom, you know, at the root, it's whether or not we believe radically enough in the power and the love of God through the gospel to save all whom he has chosen, and whether or not we will therefore sort of give our lives over to this message in such a way that we are compelled in love to make it known to whomever the Lord places in our path.
Right. Well, and that's what I really love about what you say in the book. You know, the title is The Gospel for Muslims. The subtitle is An Encouragement to Share Christ with Confidence. And I love the fact that you focus on the gospel itself. And it's not, you know, it's not saying, okay, do I need to know the Quran inside and out? Do I have to have all these cultural clues about, how Muslims live? It is knowing, I mean, the real power is in the gospel and the power of the Holy Spirit to change hearts. And so I love how you really focus on that. But you do, kind of in the second part, you do give some practical suggestions really for talking with Muslims about Christ. And what would you say, Thabiti, is just a good springboard, like for, you know, a lot of our listeners are on college campuses where there are a number of diverse religions, or they are going to be friends or be in classes with Muslims. What are good conversation starters that aren't, you know, just going to get them into a quagmire of weirdness? Or maybe that's good. Maybe they need to be in a quagmire of weirdness and bust a Jesus cap on them. That's what I say.
Taking the quagmire off my shoes, yeah. Man, from having been stuck in some of that. And the first thing is, know that that's going to happen. You're going to get in conversations where it's just sort of Bible ping pong, and the guy you're talking to is trying to score points, and sometimes in our flesh we want to win the argument too. I remember being on a subway ride to D.C. one morning, and this guy, Muslim guy, spied me out on the platform reading my Bible, and he sat next to me, and boy, he handed it to me for 40 minutes on the train. I was just not ready to have that conversation. But at the end of the day, what we want to do is get to Jesus. Mm. And that's not really that difficult with most Muslims, because most Muslims are eager to say two things. Number one, we respect Jesus as a prophet and respect him more highly than you Christians. And number two, Jesus is not the Son of God, and you know, belief in him is not how you get to heaven. Well, when a Muslim says that, we're automatically on home field advantage. We're on home turf. So starting the conversation, getting into conversations with Muslims about Christ and the gospel really is just about as simple as saying, hi, how are you? My name is, you know, blank, and just striking up conversation. So what we need to do is relinquish our passive approach to friendships and reach out in hospitality, open up our lives a little bit. Most international students studying in the States will never be in an American home. That's to our shame. Mm-hmm. And so we should really repent of that lovelessness, of that lack of hospitality, and we should open our lives, open our homes, open our mouths, just start conversation, befriend people, and sooner or later, if it's a Muslim person, particularly who cares about religious things, not just sort of a secular Muslim, the conversation will turn to Jesus pretty easily. That's been my experience, both in the States, in the Middle East, wherever I've had opportunity to talk with Muslim people.
Yeah. Now, is there the challenge of kind of intertwining or trying to find a way to dissect religious views from maybe the cultural influences that are involved in that? I always say that, you know, this is funny. The example I think of is a lot of my family's in northern Minnesota, and you've got all the Lutherans up there. And I'm like, some of these Lutherans act like it's their ethnicity, you know? They're like, this is the church that I was born in, baptized in, married, you know, I'm going to be buried here. And it's like never, you know, never can they step outside the doors of their own church, because it's like their own little cultural enclave, you know? So what kind of sensitivities do individuals have to have just to the cultural kind of entrenchment of the Muslim culture and how that's affected people?
That's a very good observation, and as you point out with the example in Minnesota, we see this in so many ways, the way religious identity gets sort of forged together with cultural identity and ethnic identity and so forth.
Mm-hmm. And with the Jews as well, with Jewish folks.
Absolutely. I think, yeah, we can multiply the examples of that. And I think what I would want to say to that is, in the long arc of redemption, what Christ is doing is pulling people from all of those various sort of pockets and making them one new people. And part of what it means for Christ to make us one new people is over the long arc, he's going to be giving us one new culture, a kind of gospel culture that we increasingly embody and live out. So what I would want to suggest is that you not front-load all of that in your evangelism, because invariably then you're going to be sort of driven off into conversations about politics and culture and things of that sort. But in the evangelism, in the sharing of Christ, to try and zero in really on Christ and on the cross and be mercenary about the gospel and applying the gospel to your friend in conversation there. The cultural things are sort of come out in the wash, as my mama would say.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if we are not ourselves just sort of blindly imbibing our own cultural biases, then I think it's going to be a fun project where we're mutually helping each other sort of think about where the gospel begins and ends and where sort of cultural assumptions creep in. And that will be one way in which the Lord will sanctify us as we do the work of evangelism.
We hear the Christmas angels, the great glad tidings tell. Oh, come to us, abide.
I appreciated the Boundless segment on adoption. Foster care and adoption have tugged at my heart, especially in light of James 1:27. And I'm glad that there are so many ways that singles can be involved with serving foster kids and families, even if we ourselves are not in a position to adopt. And I wanted to thank the Boundless team for giving us this ministry that helps to fill the generation gap between Adventures and Odyssey, which is great too, and focus on the family's daily broadcast. Thank you again. Bye.
There are currently about 114,000 legal orphans in the United States. They're in foster care, but these are not permanent placements. They're just temporary homes while these kids are waiting for someone to step up and adopt them permanently. There are more kids than that in foster care, but those kids will hopefully be reunited with their birth family. But for these kids who literally have nobody at this point, they don't have any contact with their birth families because it's been determined it's not a safe situation for them. So now these kids are just waiting for a family to step up. And unfortunately, we as Americans tend to have a lot of misconceptions about foster care, what it means to adopt from foster care, who the kids are in care, and it tends to prevent us from moving forward with adoption of these kids. But as Focus, we believe strongly that no matter their age or race or gender or special challenges or whatever, these kids need a permanent family, and foster care is better than some other situations they could find themselves in, but it's certainly not the ideal. So we've done 8 events now. We've recruited just over 1,260 families to initiate this process of adoption, which we're just completely thrilled about. The Lord is opening amazing doors, and we're so excited about that. But we also do some campaigns specifically here in November to talk about the bigger picture of adoption and orphan care, because this issue, yes, is happening here in the U.S., but it's happening in every country around the world. And the current estimates are somewhere in the neighborhood of 160 million orphans in the world, which is quite a large number. It's about half the population of the United States. So if you can just imagine that number of vulnerable and at-risk kids throughout the world in such desperate situations. And so we know not every family is called to adopt, and I'll never say that you should definitely adopt, but we are all called to do something. And there's such a myriad of opportunities to get involved with that we want to make sure that folks know those opportunities and are at least aware of what God's heart is towards these kids.
Yeah, I think it's just a rockin' opportunity that we have. And for any of you out there who think that Focus on the Family is still your mom's ministry, or that it doesn't apply to you, or that you don't have, we don't have anything going on, or we're so 1980s, whatever, you need to check out what we have going on specifically with these initiatives, because it's huge. Now, many of us know, as young adults, 20s and 30s mostly in this audience, we know someone who's been adopted, or we know someone who came out of the foster care system. And obviously adoption is nothing new, but I think it would help for us to step back and recognize that there are even young adults out there now who, because they were adopted and had to deal with challenges, whether with birth parents or kind of going through that process of if they were adopted as a baby or maybe later in life, whatever, there are some transitions that happen there. And I think more than that, there's even that understanding that, you know, at the heart of every child, you know, there is that need or that desire to belong and to be loved. And obviously, ultimately, that comes from the Lord. And that's why our adoption into his family is paramount. But Esther, I wanted you to just share a little bit of your story, because I think it is so indicative of how not only it reflects the heart of God to understand what it means to be part of a family and to be part of the family of God, but when a young adult now stands here and recognizes, maybe my family situation wasn't the best, and maybe whether that was through just growing up in dysfunction or whether that was outright rejection, there's a hole that is left there. And I want you to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, you know, often when we look at the millennial generation here at the ministry, we realize that they're a very entitled generation. And so a lot of kids that are born in Beverly Hills and mansions and, you know, with kind of what we consider the great life, the blessed life, they often feel that they deserve that. But, you know, the reverse of that is also true. And kids that come from just abandoned situations, which is my story, often feel like they deserve that as well. So I did come from a very broken home. My father left at an early age, and my mother shortly after that. And that did include both of their extended families. So the good news is that the scripture is true. And so in Psalm 68, when God says he places the lonely in families, that's what he did for me. So I was able to avoid the foster care system, which was great because my church just looked around and saw a kid in need and took me in. And so there's been several families, even to this day, that have loved me like a daughter, like a sister. And that love has changed my life, but has also shown me what God looks like. And, you know, just as the Lord adopts us when we have nothing to offer, these families took me in when I had nothing to offer. So that love has definitely changed my life. But just getting older, you know, I'm 28 now, so at the upper end of the millennial spectrum, I do realize that, you know, Thanksgiving is around the corner, Christmas is around the corner, and holidays are still hard because you still have that desire for a permanent family. And that's still something that, you know, that is hard for me this time each year. So I hope to help be a part of the solution. And I definitely, my friends know me as an advocate for children. I want to see these children placed in homes, and I want to love them well until they are and even after.
Mm-hmm. I know you and I, Katie, when we were talking, you were mentioning, you know, people that talk to you or talk to others and just say, even at the holidays, I wish I had a dysfunctional family to go home to. I mean, to have something that's completely messed up and dysfunctional is better than having, I mean, you know, in their eyes, because it's that sense of belonging and what that means.
Right. And too often we look at kids in foster care and say, well, if they'll just make it to 18, then they can get out of the foster care system and move on. Mm-hmm. Which is, you're right, they will no longer be in the foster care system, but it's certainly not a better situation. A large percentage of these kids never go to college. They barely finish high school. They end up on the streets. They're homeless. They're on the public welfare system. These are folks that we visit in jail, that we're feeding in the homeless shelters. And so we need to be aware that the permanence of a family is so important to these kids. Even if they are able to take those next steps and get a job or maybe start attending a college or university, they have nowhere to go on Thanksgiving and Christmas. The dorm shut down, so then what am I supposed to do? Mm-hmm. Or I need to sign for a school loan. Well, there's no one who's going to sign co-sign a loan for me so I can even go to school. Mm-hmm. So then I'm just caught in this endless cycle. And without having a support of people around you, it's hard to get yourself out of that. Of course, there are a few exceptions, but as a general rule, these kids would long for a family that they could go back and fight with their brothers and sisters and have the tension between grandma and Aunt Martha or whatever the case may be. They just wish they had some place to go, even if it was what we'd consider that dysfunctional situation.
Yeah, that's so true. And just, it's so crazy to me to think that people look at it in that way of just, well, it's just the pragmatics, you know, just keep the kids fed, get them some backpacks for school, whatever. And then when they're 18, then they can, you know, it's right. much, so much more than that. So,
and we as Christians recognize that because of what God has instilled in us and our desire to connect and our desire to be in communion with other people and the closeness of a family and the way, it, you know, again, adoption reflects his heart of welcoming us in when, like Esther said, we were dirty and disgusting and and all of our shortfalls, but he has welcomed us into that family. And that's what these kids are in a position of doing. And we actually were talking with a young woman who was adopted when she was fairly young, but she made the comment that, I feel sorry for you because you don't really understand your adoption into God's kingdom because you've not been earthly adopted. And I can really understand what that means to come from that situation and be welcomed into a family and have that permanent connection now. And I'm sorry that you can't fully understand that here on this earth. And it just was an interesting perspective to come at from her view.
Okay, Paul, so you are on the other end of adoption, kind of this story. You and your wife Julie have adopted two little boys now, and I know that, you know, you grew up in a very in an intact home. You kind of had the, you know, all American kind of family. I know you love your parents and are close to them, and probably didn't, you know, sit there in high school or in college and say, you know, the one thing I'm going to do is make sure that I adopt two kids, you know, and and have that be part of my story. Tell us a little bit about how that came about.
Yeah, I mean, if you wanted to find a Norman Rockwell kind of picture, I mean, I have Norman Rockwell's hanging in our house. I mean, that's sort of my background. And so when we were married, you know, we just assumed we would have a family and it would come about just naturally, and it didn't. And so, you know, we just pursued every different option. And when adoption was first presented to us, it was extremely overwhelming. It was extremely intimidating. I thought, there is no way I can handle that, because in this situation that we were first presented with, it was an open adoption. And so the birth mother would be in our son's life, his whole life, and we would have interaction. And it just was a little bit too much for a buttoned-down traditional guy to handle. Mm-hmm. Julie was a bit more easygoing about it, and she kind of carried me along. But, you know, in some ways, I feel like I'm a guy who fell into a great fortune, because it wasn't anything I did and it wasn't anything I looked for, but it just came our way. And it truly just evolved. And after the first adoption, we were, you know, interested in adding another sibling. And that, too, didn't come about through conventional means. We were on a waiting list to adopt a little child. We didn't say boy or girl. We were matched with a birth mom. And then upon birth, the birth mom changed her mind. And so, you know, you go right back down into the bottom of the barrel and you're struggling and you think, why did this happen? And then 5 days later, the phone rings and there's a baby born to a mother who didn't know she was pregnant, which it's on, I guess there's a show on MTV to this effect, so it must be true. Mm-hmm. And but she gave birth and she left the hospital, and then we were called and asked, are you interested in assuming the legal risk, because at this time the birth dad was at large. So, you know, we had another choice to make, and thank goodness we made the right choice. More promptings to my wife, because she said, there's a little child who needs a home. He's literally, can you imagine in the nursery, there's nobody in this hospital who loves that child. You have a nurse taking care of him, but there's no advocate. And so we you know, jumped in, and we're on the great ride of adoption now.
Did you, on the front end of this whole journey, before you guys even knew about Riley, you know, your oldest son, did you have those moments of thinking to yourself, I don't know if I can really love kids that aren't my biological kids as much as I would my own? Did you go through that struggle?
You know, I didn't really think too much about that. I just didn't think I could. You know, to me, adoption was just for someone else. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, we're the same age. We grew up in an era where if you were adopted, you probably looked different because you were from Korea or maybe from China. But we didn't really know too many domestic adopted people because it was kind of kept quiet. Mm-hmm. You just didn't know it. So it just was, I never really thought about it. But, you know, the minute I held Riley in my arms, you know, it's over. I mean, you've fallen in love with him. And, you know, I heard Patricia Heaton say, you know, she's from Everybody Loves Raymond. She said, I used to think I knew what it meant to love somebody until I had a child. It just redefines what it really means to love somebody. And that's been our experience.
Radiant beams from thy holy face, with the dawn of redeeming grace,
love your show. I really liked episode 138 when you had what a guy's thinking discussion on the round table, and that was just great to get a guy's point of view on asking women out. And one thing that was really a highlight for me was not to always be available for just, you know, just hanging out with guys isn't bad, but just like a lot of single women in my church would be like, let's cook dinner for all the single guys and stuff. Like, no, like, they can cook their own dinner, you know. So it was just really a good show, and I definitely told it to a few of my single ladies to not really be available to be like a doormat to the single guys so they could step it up. So thank you for the podcast. Love it and listening. Bye.
It came upon the midnight clear, the glorious song of old, from angels bending near the earth to touch their harps of gold.
I threw this out on Facebook this week, a question that I have because I've been talking with some women about it, this general frustration of guys asking them out and not really knowing what's up with this weird dance of how they decide to ask them out, how long they're going to wait, what they're not, you know, not going to wait about and whatever. So because women get two things. They get the whole he's just not that into you speech, which is basically, look, don't do a thing about it. If the guy's interested, he will find a way to spend time with you. So don't try to interpret all these signs and be all like, you know, oh, I think he looked at me and all this stuff and be all crazy like that. But on the other hand, I have known very many situations where the guy was interested and didn't do a single thing about it. And he was like trying to figure out all these signs from her and figure out what was going on. Or he had heard from a friend who said a friend said a friend said a friend said that maybe she wasn't as interested in him or she was interested in
someone
else.
Can you repeat that, by the way? I want to hear that again.
A friend said that, you know, that she was interested in someone else or maybe she just thought of him as a friend, whatever. And then it just paralyzed him and he didn't do anything until 6 years down the road when he finally decided to do something. I mean, whatever. Okay. So what I want to know, and this is what I asked on Facebook, is what does a guy think about before he asks a girl out? What actually makes him make the move? And what does he need to know about her or about the situation or whatever before he decides to actually go there? Women need to know. So let's start talking.
For me, it's very simple. This is Jeremy.
J-Dog, what's up?
My criteria initially was, I think we talked about this earlier, attractive and then Christian.
Okay.
And it turned out it was actually Christian and then attractive, but hey, they kind of go hand in hand. Mm-hmm. So when those two are good to go, yeah, I kind of went for it.
Okay. Hmm. You're talking about with your wife or with anyone?
If I ever wanted to have a date, yes.
Okay. Okay. So
specifically
now,
my wife.
Okay. But how did you find out those two things? You found out she was a Christian because...
Mine's not fair. I went to first grade with my wife.
Okay.
So I knew she was a Christian.
She was heartily pursuing after Jesus at that point.
That's one of the takeaways is really have a long research period.
That's it. Yeah. From first grade until college. And then,
it's safe
to it.
Yeah. Safe to go
for it.
That's
a little bit more of a legitimate period to be doing that from like 30 to 45. So.
No, I actually knew our families were kind of aware of each other. We weren't exactly close, mm-hmm. you know, family knit or anything like that. But I knew that she was a Christian. And so I simply asked her, hey, do you want to go running? Because I knew she was a runner. And mm-hmm. I had a little, you know, junk in my trunk. So I want to get rid of that. But I figured, hey, you know, that's a good way to get into it. And then called her last second to say, hey, we're not running. We're actually going to dinner. And kind of eased into it that way.
Okay.
And then
didn't help the junk in the trunk situation.
No, but. No, but she opened the door and I was sold. So it was a matter of, at that point, just figuring out what kind of competition I had.
Okay.
And that was it.
Now, how much time had you spent with her prior to this? Because you said attraction.
Zero.
Okay, so you said attraction. So did you just think she was cute or did you wait for this elusive chemistry or what did you, what were you waiting for?
There's no elusive anything. If you're attractive, I would know it right away. And okay. So my wife was attractive and I knew it right away.
Okay.
So I didn't say necessarily I want to marry you right then, but let's be honest, you know. So
okay.
That is pure honesty right that here is. On the Boundless Show.
That's it.
Thanks, Jeremy.
That is.
So. Well, Lisa, I want to jump in because what I'm hearing from you on this question is what's going through a guy's mind? I mean, so obviously you're going, are you attractive or not? It's mm-hmm. like Jeremy was saying, and are you a Christian or not? But, I want to kind of touch bases. I sometimes think that because of society, media, some of the different things that are out there, that in a guy's mind, really the one thing that most guys are probably thinking about is them. I mean, as much as they want the relationship, I kind of think that guys are going, okay, what is it going to look like from my friend's perspective if I go chase this girl? What are her
Hence
friends?
Attractive.
And yeah, what are her friends going to be thinking about this? Is this going to blow my reputation? Is this going to make me look like a freak? Am I going to look like a stalker? I think one of the things that's influencing guys probably more today than ever is fear. Within that whole concept. So I appreciate a guy like Jeremy, and I know Mike's dating a gal right now, who are willing to overcome that fear and get down to the process of saying, man, I'm going to take a risk and ask this girl out.
Okay.
The risk is really what it's about. I think what feeds into that fear is even Facebook. I know a lot of guy friends that resist the urge to put, I'm in a relationship, I'm dating this person, I'm engaged, on Facebook simply because they don't want to feed into that fear. I mean, they're taking a risk, that's a cool risk, and just leave it and allow the relationship to develop over time without putting these external pressures onto it.
But these are guys who have already jumped into it.
Yeah.
Well, what it seems, though, what I've seen people say is that it's easier to ask, like the phenomenon that I see is within churches, guys not asking out the women within their acquaintance. They'll usually go find someone else because maybe it's a lower risk, because if it doesn't work out, no one needs to know that they asked them out, and then it's just kind of like it goes under the carpet or whatever. Whereas if you ask someone out within your circle of friends, all of a sudden it can be this drama fest of, well, and this is the women's fault too, because then, you know, they go out to Starbucks once, and then all of a sudden the women are like, so we went out and it was so amazing and he's amazing and blah, blah, blah. And it starts this whole backstory to it when it was really just one date. And then if it ultimately doesn't work out, whether after a week or a month or whatever, then you kind of got that whole, you know, here was our story, this is what happened with us. And guys don't really want to play into that either, so that could be a little scary. But at the same time, it's like, whoa, you know, what's up with, I don't know, there's a certain amount of fear, like Mike said, with asking someone out that you know. And, you know, on Facebook, when I threw this out, there were a couple guys who said, like, they're going to find out all this stuff about a girl. Like, one guy finally said, you know, well, if it's a girl that I don't really know well, or I just met her at church, or she was introduced to me by someone else, you know, then usually after a week, I'll decide to ask her out. But if it's a girl that has been a friend or whatever, it can be like 2 to 3 years. And I was like, 2 to 3 years?
No way.
What is going on in 2 to 3 years? I don't understand that.
Nothing like, good.
Yeah.
Okay, well, speak to that a little bit, because I just don't understand. I mean, there were guys on here that were saying they need to know her political beliefs. They need to know her religious background. They need to know, you know, that she's going to be fun, or that she's going to, you know, what her family ties are. What are her passions? I thought that's what you use dating for.
Yeah, that is what you use dating for. I have a hard time understanding this concept of hanging out for years and years. And if you're going to be intentional, I really do think, and we've talked about this, that if you're a guy and you're interested in a girl, unless you are just so immobilized by fear, which can be the case, I think you're going to try and figure out a way to make something happen. And so even in the case of a stranger, there might be a reason that that girl's a stranger, because the guy's actually scared, because that's a prospect for the guy, potentially. And a girl that's in the friendship zone, I think that it can maybe work itself out of it. But the guy, if he's dragging things out, my wife and I were talking about this last night, and this was what she was saying. She goes, you know what? I just really struggled when there were guys who I was interested in, and they would come up to me and say, hey, what are you doing this Saturday? And she'd be going, oh, sweet. It's going to be a date. It's going to be a date. And she'd say, well, you know, not much. And the guy would go, okay, sweet. I hope you have a good weekend. And so, but then,
well, bait and switch.
Exactly. So, but this would happen over and over, and you could tell that the guy was interested, but never took it anywhere. So ultimately the friendship's awkward. Everything gets more awkward because the guy never had enough gumption. And then finally she finds somebody who she's interested in. And then the guy waves his hand and says, hey, why don't we go out on a date? So I don't know. I guess what I would probably encourage guys, if that you're in this friendship tango with a girl, take the chance and say, hey, let's grab a cup of coffee outside of this group. Because I want to get to know a little bit more about you. And it doesn't have to be awkward, weird, and you can just talk before you stalk.
Right, and let's
talk before you stalk.
Check it, you
Brought
heard
to
it
you
here.
By Travis.
Okay. Let's also not forget the, I mean, there's risk involved and all that, but God really is sovereign.
Amen.
I mean, in your pursuit of a woman, let's hope that if it's not going that direction, that as a guy you'll communicate, hey, you know what? I thought this was going in this direction initially, and I don't really feel like it's working out. I mean, the worst, I mean, that is the worst, but at least communicate that the risk will always be there. I am pursuing a girl that's outside of my friend group, and it actually, there's a lot of benefits to it because there's less risk if it doesn't work out. But I mean, so far the Lord has proved sovereign in showing me, you know what, Mike, this is happening not like it's happened before. And you are taking the proper steps. You're seeking me. You're pursuing her. And this is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, God is sovereign.
I think that's so key. What Mike just touched on is recognize your relationship with God. Mm-hmm. I mean, if he is truly in your life, if you really are walking with God, what do you have to fear in this realm?
Mm-hmm.
Is that God, if he is sovereign, like the Bible says he is, then he's going to guide. He's going to show. He's going to protect, you know, hopefully those relationships if you're honoring him.
Go tell it on the mountain, over the hills and everywhere. Go tell it on the mountain that Jesus Christ is born, that Jesus Christ is born.
Hey, I hope you had as much fun as I did listening to these clips and reflecting on 2010 as it was evidenced in the Boundless show. Again, we appreciated hearing from you, those of you who gave a shout out and selected your favorite clips and gave them to us. And we hope you enjoyed listening. Stay tuned next week. We're going to have part two of the show, more clips for you, kind of a retrospective again on the year. Hopefully you're having fun with your family and you are enjoying last week's podcast, which, remember, talked about the family dynamics, so make sure that you're doing that well and that you are having a Christ-like attitude in all things. So we will see you next week for more of the Best of the Boundless Show 2010. Merry Christmas, everyone.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org. Focus on the family.